Hi, my name is Clemens. I'm a technical lead at Microsoft for the Service Bus, Windows Azure App Fabric Service Bus, the full name of the product. And this is a session that's a follow-up. It's kind of the extension session, the advanced subject sessions of session 862 for the Build Conference. And so we're recording this today, several days before the Build Conference even starts. In the studio here back in Redmond. And then the actual session, you're going to get this session, of course, once the actual session happens over in Anaheim. And the recommendation is, I'm going to have that again in the deck, is that you go and watch session 862. That should be linked somewhere on the page that this video is hosted. And then come back, because this is kind of the extension, the extra 60 minutes help you understanding some deeper concepts for Service Bus and for the new features, along with some demos and some more advanced subjects. The session, like in the classic way, is a kind of a 400 session. We're going to go fairly deep on some of the aspects, specifically on subjects like correlation. And so it's meant not as an introductory session. The introductory session is going to be 862 that you can still watch the video of, and this one is kind of the extension of it, as said. So let's jump right in. This is about Service Bus, our standard introduction slides. We have connectivity, messaging, and so this is going to be mostly about messaging and the new capabilities that we have in Service Bus, and kind of a depth walk through some of the extended capabilities that we have beyond just pure message passing. I'm also going to go into some. I'm going to use some terminology as we talk about federation. So there's some terminology as I use it. I think there's necessarily authoritative guidance on any of those terms that we can rely on from within the industry. So the way I'm using things is fairly loose. I'll use cloud as self-service, managed IT and platform assets that run someone else's data center. Hosted is something also running on someone else's data center, but not necessarily this self-service, and you commonly care about the individual nodes, while in the cloud you don't. On-premise is stuff that runs on your system, and hybrid app, and that's the important term here. That's why I have all these other definitions, is really any application that spans data centers and or sites and or any of the above. So what Service Bus is for is enabling hybrid applications that span cloud and on-premise, or on-premise and on-premise, that federate apps across different environments. And of course, it's also very useful for building cloud applications inside of Windows Azure. I'm going to show you also an example of how you can very well use Service Bus very well in some in-the-cloud scenarios. So what are hybrid apps? By that definition, what we use that for, it's something like a cloud web app that wants to go and integrate with applications that are kind of hosted by partners, that are on-premise in your own, on your own site, where you have a line of business application, where you have native clients or web clients that are talking to your cloud web application directly using REST services, using JSON and JavaScript extensions. But you can also have those clients talk to Service Bus through Service Bus directly for all kinds of reasons, including feedback channels. You send a request off to for backend processing. Backend processing takes a while, and then you can go and notify that device, or the device can go and pick up the results at a later point in time. It's all things you can facilitate using Service Bus. So two core jobs for Service Bus in the hybrid app scenario: first, to enable robust intra-application messaging for cloud applications inside of Windows Azure. But also in other environments if you wanted to. And then also federating applications across sites, trust and network boundaries. That's kind of how Service Bus, how we see Service Bus positioned. In that vein, I took a picture of from a website from Asperasoft. There's a company who is selling a file transfer product, and so I took that picture. It's an interesting picture because it shows you something that is important to know and to note when you think about hybrid applications. So that's why I bring that up. TCP is very much affected by round trip time and by the packet loss that you'll experience on the wire. So if, as you're building hybrid applications, as you're building applications that bridge the cloud and bridge on-premise, one thing you always need to keep in mind that it's not the local area network. That you have a network world, where you have latency in play. We have a world where you have packet loss in play. And once you have packet loss, once you have round trip times which exceed, and they easily do, 50 to 100 milliseconds between your application pieces, there are some consequences that you need to, there are some consequences for your application. And those will affect your design and how you build your apps. So the rule of thumb is your throughput ceiling for a system is defined by the window size, the TCP window size, which is 64K standard. There's of course window scaling, but the window scaling is negatively affected by the packet loss, which is always present. So in our experience, you'll always hover just right around the 64K, probably a little less, probably a little bit more, but not a lot. And then the latency in seconds is gating that. So if you have a window size that's standard 64K and you have latency of 100 milliseconds, 0.1, then 640 kilobytes per second is your ceiling for throughput. And 100 milliseconds is something that you will actually see on the internet fairly frequently. So there's several ways to deal with that. There's alternate protocols, or you can use multiple sockets. But that's something that's really important. This is why I have that here kind of as the lead-in. Something really important, if you think about hybrid applications, if you're building hybrid applications with service bus or with any other technology that relies on any other communication mechanism that relies on TCP, that's something that you always should keep in mind. So based on that, for hybrid apps, whether they're using service bus or not, here's some general advice. First, you should not expect to get LAN throughput. If you go and have a hybrid application that spans the cloud and on-premise, or that spans multiple systems, if you're putting those systems together, you will not get LAN throughput, and speed of light as long, at least is working against you. When you're building systems today that are okay with chatty traffic inside of the internet, intranet, you need to consider that a 50 millisecond round trip time is very long if you are chatty. If you're doing 10 calls, it's 500 milliseconds. You can do the math. And so you're racking up very, very long, just round trip latency times very quickly if you have very chatty behavior. So the goal is to make your calls chunky. The goal is to do batching. And you need to also consider what your trade-offs are between timeliness, you know, making things fast, and having full consistency in your system. You can't have both. So if you can't be either very correct but slow, or you can be less correct but faster. So if you are updating an address record on one side of the world, it is typically okay to have that address record updating several seconds later on the other side of the world, and have the other side of the world work with somewhat stale data in the meantime. Also, what's important is whether you want to move big data sets around or whether you want to just go walk up to those data sets instead. If you have a large database that sits on-premise, and if you want to go and move that and want to replicate that all the time, and you have a lot of churn in that database, it probably makes more sense for your app to just walk up to that on-premise database using and fronting with the service, and then use something like Service Bus to get to it. So that's just some general advice before we get into the depth of it into Service Bus. So some repetition, if you've seen the session 862 live as a recording from Anaheim, there's going to be some repetition here, but I need to have that information for you, so I can refer to it a little later. So there's some very basic patterns here I'm going to talk about. So the first one is load leveling, where the receiver is able to receive and process data at its own pace. So if you have the sender sends in great bursts. The receiver basically just gets a message, processes it, gets the next message, and processes it, and all the burstiness gets queued up in the queue, and so the load is leveled on the receiver. The receiver never gets overstressed as more data gets pushed to it, and the sender can also very nicely get rid of that data and secure it in the queue. So that's very different. That's one of the difference between a direct transfer and a broker transfer. If you have the broker in the middle and have storage in the middle, you get the very nice behavior of load leveling, where the sender can send at a higher rate and the receiver can go and process it at its own speed and eventually catch up. And of course, you can add further receivers, and we're going to go to that later. The other wonderful thing is that you can do offline operations. So you can go and send data, and either the receiver is offline because it just doesn't have any network, or this receiver may be offline because you only want to do batch processing. If you have data that accumulates over the course of a day, but you really only want to go and pull that into some repository or do an evaluation of that data once a day, because that's sufficient, you can just make those resources, the processing resources, available once a day, have them offline for most of the day, and then make them available once a day, run that kind of in a batch fashion, go do all the processing, and then shut those resources off again. So having a queue is actually very nice for for creating batching. Load balancing is the other good quality, so that's the other side of load leveling, if you will. You can have multiple receivers compete for messages on the same queue. You can also do the same thing on a subscription on Service Bus. And that provides effectively automatic load balancing. Load balancing, if you think about it, that what we do in TCP or in HTTP, there's some load balancer that's pushing, that's picking an endpoint and basically pushing to it. And here, but it usually doesn't know what the load is. Here in this pull model, where you have a receiver that goes and solicits a message and gets it back and solicits a message and gets it back, the receivers are very aware how much capacity they have, and they only get as much data and as many jobs as they can actually go and process. So having a model where you have competing consumers sitting in a queue gives you load balancing without overstressing any of the individual receivers, and that's a wonderful characteristic of a queue, of queues and subscriptions. The other thing is an additional thing is the fan in. That's kind of the other side of this. You can have any number of senders, and again, you can't stress out the receiver if you go and do a fan in. So you have one place, and in the Service Bus case, that place is not even in your data centers, in the cloud, that takes all the inbound traffic, queues it up into queue, and the queues that we have capacity from 1 to 5 gigabytes. So you can put a lot of events into those messages, and then process them off as the receiver has time. So if you have bursty traffic specifically, so if you get almost no traffic, if you get periodical bursts, you have no traffic during the hour, and then at the top of the hour you get a lot of senders who are sending data in a rush, all of that goes into Service Bus, and then the receiver can go at its own pace and over the course of the hour go and drain the queue and do all the processing. And of course, on the other side is if we go and move to from the competing consumer model to the fan-out model, we have topics where you can have multiple subscriptions on these topics, and that's good for distribution. So you send a message in, every subscriber gets a copy, and the subscribers also have a way to go and filter on those messages. Filtering, you can define a filter, or in fact up to 2,000 filter conditions on a single subscription in Service Bus, and each match rule will yield an individual message copy. So you can use this for filtering, you can use this for correlation, as we'll see later, and you can use it for partitioning, as I'll show you in a moment. The way those filters are expressed is they're simple SQL 92 expressions that run over a message property. So I'm going to show you an example of that in a few moments. So one of the things you can do here is you can use partitioning. So you can define, in addition to doing filters on subscriptions, where you just have a receiver who's just interested in certain messages, you can create a partitioning model where you have a partitioned set of receivers that are dealing with separate sets of data. And in the incoming message is a partition identifier. And now you can go and assign data to particular partitions by creating mutually exclusive ranges by ways of filters over subscriptions. So here you send into the topic, and not everybody gets a message, but really the message is routed to the right partition. The reason why that makes a lot of sense is because the sender doesn't need to be aware where to send the data to. And you can easily reshuffle, can make the partition ranges lighter, you can make the partition ranges smaller by reconfiguring the subscriptions and the contained rules. So you're creating a decoupling between the senders and the partitioning model that you may have on the other end. And as you need to go and grow up your partitionings, your partitions, or shrink your partitions in your architecture, you can do that. You can tune that very nicely and programmatically by just setting up new subscriptions or just changing the rules on the additional subscriptions. So that's a wonderful thing to do. So let's go into a quick demo of the basic patterns before we go to the more advanced subjects. So I have a sender here, and the sender is just our simple getting started sample that we have in the SDK. I just hardwired some credentials here. So what I'm going to do, show you first, is obviously the offline case, because that's the simplest one. So I'm going to send some messages that are going into the queue. And that's about some package deliveries. And now we're going to go into the receiver, and I'm going to go and run that receiver. And even though that receiver hasn't been running, obviously it's able to go and get all the messages that we just sent, eight of them. So that was number one. So now let's go and let's take a look at the load leveling part, and also the fan in part. So I have the receiver here. Or the senders here. Let's go and start some senders. Start a sender. I'm going to start another sender. I'm going to start another sender. And all of them are sending the messages. And of course, you can imagine the higher the rate is, the receiver just is not affected by how many senders I have. That's a very simple example, obviously. What's obviously next is to show you the exact opposite side. So that was fan in. Let's go and take a look at the load balancing part now. So we go and close those senders again, and we're going to go and abort that receiver. Now we're going to go and start a few more receivers. So let's go and start the receiver. So that's the first one, the second one, a third one. I have all those here, and now we're going to go and start just one sender. And as we send to the queue, there's automatic load balancing happening because they're all competing for messages on the same queue. So you now see them automatically distributed into those queues. So fan in is very easy, obviously, because you get that buffering in the middle, and then fan and then go to individual load balance destinations by ways of competing consumers is also very easy. So let's open the solution here for the filter so I can show you that, how the filters work. And so we're going to go and just go into the setup portion here. And here's where we create the subscriptions and actually set the filter. So there's several ways to define those filters. And I had talked about the partitioning filter. As you create a new subscription, you can go and, as you create the subscription, you can supply a filter that's a default filter, and then you can go and add additional rules, additional filter rules later. But here we're just showing you how to set those up. So the first one is the true filter, and that's kind of the default catch-all. That's also the default if you don't specify a filter. What that does is just gives you all the messages that maybe that show up in the topic. And the next is a SQL filter. The SQL filter lets you go and do expressions over properties. So the color equals blue, quantity equals 10, and then so this is the SQL 9092 expression syntax that you can use there, and that's documented with the SQL filter. And then there's a correlation filter, and that is actually referring to the correlation ID. So you're going to see that later in another demo. So I just want to show you doing the partitioning pieces or doing the filtering pieces, the simple capabilities. And that's kind of how you set them up. And you can go to the advanced filter sample that's in the SDK under exploring features and then have that running. And so I just want to show you that sample. I just want to point that out to you. So we had a simple model where we showed Fanon, we showed load balancing, and then I showed you just quickly how it looks in code to specify your individual filters. So let's go back to the deck and talk a little bit about composite patterns. So we now had the basic patterns. So let's talk about the composite patterns. One of them, and that's something that's gaining popularity right now through a number of folks who are really engaged in the community on architectural novelties around a term called CQRS. Greg Young, Uri Dahan are two guys who are really active around this. There's a notion that you can go and effectively from a client always write through some queuing, some event infrastructure, and do all the reads straight onto stores. And that is actually gives you a really interesting set of capabilities. I'm not portraying this as the way you write CQRS. There's a lot of things to that, so you may want to look up that term. But the service bus and the capabilities actually give you a very nice way to go and deal with the eventing part of CQRS. So the notion here is just simply the update and reseparation, where you take the writes and write all the writes to a topic. And then you have a subscription, and the subscription has a reader, and the reader is actually the writer to the store. So one of the nice additional characteristics here is that now all write access to the store can be made sequential. You can have multiple concurrent readers, competing consumers, obviously, but you can now sequentialize the reads. It also is very nice for what I told you in the beginning with hybrid apps, where you have to balance between consistency and timeliness. Here, the notion is generally that consistency, perfect consistency, is not achievable in far distributed systems. But what you can very nicely do is you can go and take your writes and immediately take a system like this and don't even have a master store, but basically just have feed a lot of distributed stores which represent the same content using a transactional system, using a transactional system like this, where you can go and send into the topic in a transactional fashion, also avoiding duplication. We're going to see that later, how you can do that. And then you can go and subscribe, and you can also go and get messages using the peak lock mechanism that we have in the system, get them out, and make sure that you can actually go and write your data out, that you're not being caught by deadlocks on your data or by other transient conditions. And then you only let go of the message once you have actually written that data. Because you can make multiple subscriptions, you can actually have very many distributed databases in different places and have your consumers basically look at the same data in a distributed fashion because it's been distributed as the updates, as the writes were made. Obviously, there are certain database shapes that are better suited to this than others. If you have database with a lot of updates to existing records, that's probably not the best thing. But if you have a database where you are doing mostly inserts into the database, that's where you effectively are doing accounting on your records, then that's much better suited for that. So topics as a composite mechanism, you have topics here. and potentially competing consumers. But that's a really interesting subject and really interesting thing for how to build an architecture that will yield eventually consistency, not perfect consistency, but that really nicely balances out timeliness and consistency for a number of systems. Certainly not, it's not a golden recipe for everything. Another thing that's very important, and that's something that I'm using for the system that I'm writing right now very intensively, is update notifications. So in the beginning, there's a notion that there's a worker, and the worker is getting information, and the work is all long-running. So there are jobs that need to be performed, and they need to be performed over days or even weeks or longer, or just infinite. Something that's so long-running, so for a Windows Azure application, for instance, I have a worker, and that worker, so that's the W here, the worker will start up after reboot and basically go and get all of its assigned jobs using some partitioning mechanism and ownership mechanism from the store, and it never looks at the store again. So instead of pulling the store, it actually gets further updates or any control messages related to the jobs. It gets it straight from the sender, from the manager, some other part of the system, through a topic. So all flow, all information about updates in the system that are required to know by the workers go in through a topic infrastructure. Those can be broadcasts. So you can go and send that into the topic, and then all workers who may be interested in some configuration change in the system will go and get that. And then we'll probably go and reconfigure themselves and then reseat themselves. Or you may have individual records, individual jobs that have been submitted new. And so you flow those notifications through the system from a management part of the system or some other part of the system through to all the workers or one of the workers using, for instance, the partitioning scheme that I talked about earlier. And with that, you get very nice characteristics around the flow of jobs, around the flow of work inside of your system without requiring you to go and to do frequent lookups on the databases that put a lot of idle stress onto the databases themselves. So update notifications is a very, very useful mechanism if you have a lot of database-based information, a lot of database-based metadata, and you want to go and notify clients in your system of changes on that metadata, either in a broadcast fashion or in a targeted fashion. So also, obviously, queues are also a candidate here. If you only have a single worker, or if you just want to make sure that one worker picks them up, but these are nuances in that particular scheme. Another composite scheme, composite pattern is for diagnostic and statistics. That's something that's that I'm also using fairly regularly in the system that I'm writing right now, where you need to have information that's coming out of your system in terms of diagnostics or statistics. And the question is, how do you flow that? And how do you actually make sure that you don't overload all of your receivers? So there's several ways how you can go and do this. So first of all, you can go and create, let's ignore the picture for a moment, you can have a simple queue, and you're just pulling on one side of the queue, you're pulling all of your events out that you care about. Say they're diagnostics events, and then you're collecting them from your processes that run in Windows Azure or somewhere else. The interesting thing there is you are typically or very often interested in data that's current and less interested in data that's not so current. So one of the things you can do is you can vary the TTL, the time to live of an individual message, by severity. So you can say a warning or information or a verbose logging record has a very, very short lifetime. And if nobody's pulling them, you will not get them. You will take an error trace, and you will say that's good for 15 minutes. And you will take a fatal message, and you will say that's good for 4 hours or even a day or even longer. So that noise actually gets filtered out, goes away as time progresses, and only the really interesting messages are bubbling up. So that's one way to tune this, where you can go and just vary by severity in the topic. The other way to do this is to use topics and use filters. So you can have a topic, you can have multiple subscriptions, and you have a subscription level effectively for fatal, for error, for warning info. And of course, because they're not exclusive, you can have a client. The client has makes for itself 1, 2, 3 subscriptions that all have individual filter conditions that allow them to get the right diagnostic streams that they're interested in. And then you can go and complement that with varying the TTL by severity as you publish it into the topic, so you don't get flooded, you don't get too much noise that's not of interest into the system. As you send data into the system, as you send messages to the system, you set the TTL. As the TTL expires, those messages just disappear out of the queue. Another interesting and very valuable mechanism or composite pattern is correlation. And correlation really gives you a reply path to send. So queues and topics are typically one-way messaging, and you don't have an immediate reply path. So with correlation, and with several, there's several correlation models. I'm going to show you three that are possible with Service Bus. You can go and create very efficient request reply paths that are going through the queue with all the benefits of a queue, or through a queue or a topic, either way, that give you all the benefits. So you get the temporal decoupling. You can go and request a reply when one of the parties are offline, or when they're offline, they just have completely different lifetimes. But it doesn't necessarily have to be slow either. Sending data through a queue and replying through a queue can be very fast, but you got all the benefits of load balancing and all the patterns that I talked about before. You get all those things, all those advantages in your backend. You will not overload your transactional backend that's actually dealing with money and dealing with orders. You won't stress those things out. So there's a lot of benefits to doing it, to use the queue to insulate, or use queues or topics to insulate parts of your system. So there's three correlation models that we have in Service Bus: message correlation, subscription correlation, and session correlation. I'm going to talk about all of them. I'm actually going to show them to you in a demo in a little bit. Let's talk about the correlation as it plays a role in a system. Let's assume the senders here would be ASP.NET front ends. So you have a web app, and that web app runs obviously multiple instances, N instances, and you have, for the purpose of discussion, a receiver, a single worker backend that's doing some heavy duty lifting. Some important jobs. Let's say this is your order processing queue. So that's the order processing queue. So the front ends are doing showing the catalog, and they're dealing with all the assets. And once you push the button to say, yes, I want to go and buy this, that's when data goes into this queue, and where you can go and process it on the back end. As things go, sometimes the processing may be very quick. Sometimes it may take a little longer, depending on what that load is. So you want to get, if you get a reply, you want to get that into a reply queue. Of course, there's got to be a way how, well, the receiver knows what the right reply queue is, because now we have two candidates. Each sender has their own, so there's got to be a way to do that. And then also, there's got to be a way for the sender here to know, to be able to correlate the sent message with the reply that it's getting. So it will go and set a correlation ID, and that correlation ID will actually be the correlation ID that's being sent here will then actually flow back, and so the sender will know what message to look for. So I'm going to show you that in code a little later. And of course, the more interesting thing is that you have end-to-end with correlation. So you have ASP.NET sitting up front, doing all the work. You have a queue, and now you have multiple receivers on the back end that are getting data. And you can actually go and scale those out. You can add more workers that are doing more work by observing the length of that queue. That's a mechanism that we also make available. You can go and ask through the namespace manager. You can go walk up to an individual queue and then ask for its size. And based on that size and observing that size, you can decide whether you need more workers or whether you probably need less workers. So you can do a dynamic scale out just by observing the length of the queue. And that's how you can go and scale at the back end. Otherwise, the mechanism is kind of the same. You have you sent into the queue. Somehow, the receiver learns about what queue to reply to and also learns about a way how to provide a correlation hint to the sender. And then the message comes back, and the sender can pick it up. So I said, there's three ways to do correlation service bus. The first one is message correlation. And the second, subscription correlation via topics. The third, session correlation. There's a lot of words here. So we're going to look at correlation in ASP.NET. And I have a project here. So that project has two sub-projects. There's a Windows Azure project, two roles, background worker, correlation set. The background worker is job is to take the messages and compute the result and send them back. And the correlation set is the standard ASP.NET. MVC3 side, very minimal. And so we're just going to look at that and just look at an example here. So here's message correlation. And I'm just going to give you one example. So we're doing high math here with some large numbers that we need to go and add. And so I'm going to go create that job. The job is being played to the back end. The back end then computes that job, and we go and get back to the list. So this is these are here some completed jobs that we've done, so you get the result here. So there's three variations. I just show you on the website message correlation, and the other ones that I'm going to just going to show you in the code. But that's kind of what the basic model is. So let's look at what the code does. For that we're going to take a look at the processing jobs controller. And the processing jobs controller has all these different types. So I have the message correlation. That's the first view. That's kind of that's the thing that brings up the edit fields as they've been submitted. I'm coming back here, and so the first thing I'm doing here is I'm setting up the correlation receive loop, and what that is just a spinning loop that's fetching messages from the reply queue. So as you saw in the previous picture, we have a send queue that we send data to, and then we have a receive queue, and that receive queue, the reply queue, to be precise, the reply queue, there's one per instance. So as we create more and more instances of this ASP.NET site in Windows Azure, we're creating one queue per instance. So then what we're going to do is we get the processing job, we're going to go and add it to our context, so that's an entity framework context, we're just going to save it in the database. And now we're going to create a queue client to the message correlation queue. That's the queue that the message correlation workers that are competing for work are listening on. And then I'm going to create a new brokered message. I'm going to assign it the message ID. And I'm also assigning it this instance's reply queue name, which is including its instance ID, and then I'm going to set the properties. So the job, the operation, the first argument, the second argument. Obviously, there's some error checking that we should be doing here that I'm not doing for in the interest of brevity. And then what we're doing here is we're sending a manual reset event. Again, in purely async operations, you would probably do it a little bit differently, but that's all in the interest of space. And then I have this pending threads, a dictionary that you'll see a little later, where I'm now doing the correlation in my process, where I'm adding that message ID, that's my correlation identifier, and I'm passing this little callback. And the callback is being called when a message with that message ID as a correlation ID arrives, and then we're going to fish out the result from that message that's being returned here, and then set the reset event. So that's the setup. So now we're going to go and send that message off, and now we're going to sit here. And we're going to wait exactly 1 second, not longer. If, in the meantime, we have not received the result, we will go and remove that message ID from the pending threads dictionary and simply go back to the index. The index is this list. So if the result shows up later, we'll go and it will eventually show up in that list. I'll show you how. And then you can simply, doing a 5, you can eventually get that result. So if you don't get it right now, if your operation cannot complete right now, that's fine, because you can show the result. You can show this is not complete yet. You can show some indicator to the user that it's not complete yet and that they can go and come back later to go and pick up the result. And that's what the index list is really for. Otherwise, if we got a result, our wait is completing successfully, then we're going to go and set that onto the job. We're going to save the job again, so now the job has the result, and we redirect to the details. And that's exactly the operation that we've seen when we go and create. Let's go and do that again. If we do the message correlation and we go to do add, and we add some numbers, right? What happens is that operation actually completes, the whole round trip completes in less than a second, and then we forward back to the details. So that's where we are here. So how does the magic work? What is this pending threats thing? Well, this is how we set that up. So first of all, we said there's this correlation receive loop. That's very simple. We go and create a queue client on our receive queue that we set up. And then we start beginning the receive. And that's just using this correlation receive loop method. We say end receive. If we got a message, then we're going to look into the pending threads dictionary. Is there anybody who registered the message with the correlation ID that we just have in hand? If that's true, then we're going to remove that from the pending threads, and we're going to call the callback. If that's not true, so if nobody is currently waiting anymore, then we're just going to call handle orphan job. And then no matter what happens, we're going to re-enter the loop so it doesn't terminate. So let's go and look at handle orphan job, which is kind of at the end of this file. What that does is it simply sets up a new context. It gets the job by the job ID that's in the reply, and then finds the right processing job. And if that's found, then it sets the result on the processing job and simply saves the data. So even though the HTTP request walked away and effectively completed, there's a mechanism in that site which will go and take the orphan reply and get it, and will save the results into the database so that data doesn't get lost. So with that, you have a wonderful way to use queues to go and make a decision of how long you want to wait for an answer from the back end, and then queues here in this case. And then if you decide to walk away, you can still go and get that data because it's sitting in the queue, and then store that safely into the database. So that was the one side of the correlation mechanism. So let's go and look at the key element here. The key element that we have is the message ID on one hand. That's what we send in. That's the one that we create. And then we take that message ID. Oops, that's the wrong one. We take the message ID, set that here, and then we go and specifically key on that message ID as the correlation ID. So how does the back end of that look? The back end of that is this worker. So again, that's a receive loop. That receive loop now gets messages, and now it goes and looks at the request. And now creates a reply queue, a reply client, based on the reply to address that's in that request. So let's go and look at that as we go up here. What we said here is the reply to address. As I said, that's the reply queue. So that's being picked up over here. And now we go and evaluate the incoming request. We're going to do our calculation. We get the result, and we create the reply. And we set the correlation ID to the message ID that was coming in. We set the properties that we set for the request. And we sent that off, and now we sent that into the reply queue, providing the correlation ID. And that's the correlation ID that is being picked up. That's being picked up not here. That's being picked up by the correlation mechanism right here. So that was simple message correlation. So you have a message ID, correlation ID. You can also use a correlation ID for both, and you have this individual correlation on messages. The next one is subscription correlation. That's a variation of that. I'm going to give you a little bit of some recipes once we're through the demo. It's the same kind of mechanism. We can go a little faster. Instead of creating a queue, instead of sending data to receiving the data from a queue as a reply queue, you're actually receiving from a subscription, and that is on the topic that the sender, the replying party, it already knows. So we're no longer setting the reply to. We're simply assuming that the sender or that the replying party already knows that, but it doesn't know exactly what subscriptions we have. So we're starting to decouple the sender and the receiver from each other, and also on the reply path we're creating decoupling. And instead of coupling them together this way, we actually have individual subscriptions per each receiver. It also means that we no longer have a reply queue per party, but we can have a reply queue, we can have a single reply topic, and then do partitioning in however way we want to via subscriptions. So otherwise, we just create a message again with a message ID with the properties. On the subscription clients, now we create a rule, and we say, and this is how the partitioning works, we say, under the subscription, we create a rule with a correlation filter that's looking at the correlation ID of the incoming messages. And that's how we filter out the messages for that individual subscription. So we have one topic that's being replied to, and by ways of knowing about that message ID, that's how this subscription gets its message back. So that's a different way for how to go and direct data to the receiver, not using a queue name, but really just this correlation filter with a subscription. And the rest of the mechanism is kind of the same thing. So there's no surprise here. Instead, but we're certainly removing that rule later, as we no longer need it to do some cleanup. Let's go and look at the correlation worker. The correlation worker here, the difference that you'll notice is it creates a topic client instead of creating a queue client. And then as we send the result, we're simply sending that result into that queue. So we don't even look at a hint from the incoming message. So you will ask the question, certainly, why would you do that? And the reason for that, if the job is very long-lived, so if what we would send in here as a job would not be something that is as short-lived as this, but is something that takes a day or two, it might be unclear whether the receiver, that instance, the owner of that queue, is actually still alive. So providing you a mechanism that decouples the owner or the ownership of the reply from actual queues, from an actual reply queue, is getting the more interesting the longer that job runs. Because then you can go and take the rules, the number of message IDs that you're waiting for, and simply transfer them to a different subscription and basically transfer ownership of the replies to someone else. And that's some flexibility you get by using this subscription-based correlation model. So it gives you very nice additional failover characteristics. The third and last way how you can do this is in session correlation. And that's another feature. Here you set the session ID, and you also set the reply to session ID. And so you have a session full queue, and the session full queue is used for a reply. And here, we don't even have that reply loop. Here we basically go and just, we send the message, and then we create a queue client, and we're explicitly waiting for the message session to show up, which is the first message whose session ID is labeled with the respective session ID. Once the session shows up, we have a session. Once we have that session, we can receive the first message from that session, which is going to show up immediately, and then we're going to go and we can go and do that. That's a very, very simple mechanism. It doesn't even require a loop. However, it's somewhat more expensive than the other mechanisms. So really what this is geared for, and so it's not entirely in the right context here in this ASP.NET application, is for longer term, for long range mutual message exchanges that you can multiplex over a single queue using these session receivers, which is creating completely different separate data streams per session. So let's look at the server side of that. Server side is also very simple. You have this receive loop, as we have that before, and the way you do this is effectively just setting that session ID, and that's creating this multiplexed set of messages that you can then receive on the receive side, and you have pinning in there. So that's the story around correlation. Let's continue. So again, a summary of what's what. Message correlation, if you have high throughput needs, and the work usually completes in minimal time, and that is, it is typically the simplest mechanism you can use. Subscription correlation is if you want to further decouple the replying party and the destination, if you have different ideas, if you want to have flexible routing for the replies, then subscription correlation is a really good way to do that. And session correlation is if you want to have reliable multiplex duplex communication, or if you just want to have a sequence of messages that needs to be held together, then you use session correlation. That said, sessions are interesting not only for that, but also for something else, for workset pinning, as I call it. Workset pinning means you have a sequence of messages all labeled with the same session ID. If you have a receiver and you accept that receiver in the way that I just showed you in the other example, you get exclusive use of those. You could exclusive lock on that session. So that receiver will no longer, other receivers that are also on that queue will no longer have access to messages that are sitting in the same session. Only when that receiver is giving up its lock on that session, which means it discards that receiver, then other receivers would have a chance to get access to that session by accepting one of those sessions receivers without explicitly specifying an ID, a session ID. So to do sessions, you need to go and create some session-aware entities. The way that works is you can go and create a queue. In the queue, you create a queue description, and then you say require session equals true. That's required if you want to use the session feature. The same thing is true for the subscriptions. And then if you want to send messages as shown, you set the session ID to the session ID, and then you have the properties. If you want to receive messages, you accept the message session, specifying a message a session ID, or just leaving that empty. And if you do, then you get the next new session that shows up, and then you can start receiving. Another interesting feature we added there is session state. And session state allows you to store session state inside a service bus that's associated with a session. And it's effectively just a stream. The size limit is equivalent to one message inside a service bus. So you get 256K for your session state. And what that gives you is workset pinning with, say, failover. So let's say you have a receiver that just keeps pulling messages from the same session, and that receiver now fails, it can go and, as it receives messages, record its progress on a larger job in that session state. If now a different receiver gets the session, if they're requesting the session receiver anonymously without specifying a session ID, it can go and look into that state and look at the progress that has been made, like, you know, reassembling a file, and then pick up from there and write the remaining data into the same resource. So that's a way how you can go and have data associated with the processing of that session alongside with that session that's also stored in the queue. The way that works is create a client, you accept the message session, you start receiving messages from that session. As you make progress, you can go and set the state, and the state is really a stream, so that's presumably some serialized objects, set of objects that you want to store there, but the format is up to you. We take a stream, we yield a stream, and so it's a very basic, simple, but very powerful mechanism to deal with session processing. We also have transaction support using system.transactions, however, only local transaction. There's no distributed transaction support. You cannot enlist further participants in a transaction. What you can do here is you can create several. There's several ways to use transactions, all focused on a single entity. So the first thing you can do is you can create message batches that can only be sent together and not sent in the case of a transfer failure. So create a transaction scope, and then you can send messages, multiple messages, and it's guaranteed that they will only show up together in the queue, or they won't. So if there's a transfer failure in the middle, they won't show up. Other things is you can enable transaction operations on a single entity. So you can receive a message and delete a rule, or you can receive a message and store session state. So that gives you a way to do transactional recording of your progress using that transactional facility, but it's focused on a single entity inside of Service Bus. So there's no distributed transaction support for the time being. So very simple model: user transaction scope, system.transactions, do two sends, and complete the scope. Again, I could also go and take the example that I had before. Here with setting the state, I could receive, I can set the state, I can do that within the transaction scope, and that will happen together. So if the receive will actually roll back, the message will show up back into the queue if I am not successful setting that state. So now we're going to come to a few small features that are also very important to look at. First is time to live. And I spoke about that earlier in some of the patterns around the patterns, specifically also about diagnostics and how you can go and triage data or take classification of data and use TTL also for making sure that you don't get swamped by too verbose data. So once the TTL expires, the messages disappear. As I said, diagnostics, audits, errors, update notifications, statistics, and all kinds of things. TTL is dialable, and TTL is a very useful way to get rid of noise that you don't need anymore, that you're really interested in while it's fresh, and that gets less and less interesting as it gets stale. So you can just go and take that superfluous data and just make it go away by setting a TTL. Setting the TTL is very simple. You create a message, you set the time to live to a time span that you like, and then you send the message, and the system is enforcing it. Another time variant on this is scheduling, when you can say, I want to send a scheduled message at a certain point in time. So if you want to build a simple distributed timer or a scheduler, and you want to say, I want to send a message, I want to schedule a job to appear in exactly 2 hours, you can go and just send a message, and you set the scheduled NQ time to UTC time, and then you can take now plus 2 hours, and this message is going to show up in the queue in 2 hours. And it's going to be sorted into the queue at the place that it would be placed into if it were showing up in 2 hours. So that's a great way to build some simple scheduling. If you want to build a distributed processing loop, just as the one that I just showed you in-memory model in the correlation example, if you wanted to build that, that's actually a wonderful thing. You can go and effectively have the queue be the scheduler, or have a topic be the scheduler for a distributed system that scales across resources, and also doing what you would typically do with delays or waits in memory. You can do that with brokered messages and through the system here. Some other features that are interesting in that process, especially when you think about transactions and failure management, etc. If you have a message that you can't process for some reason, you need to be able to get rid of that message, or at least not throw it away, but have it in a safe place so you can go and inspect it and see what's wrong with it. So the facility for that is the dead letter queue. There's no automatic dead lettering for the time being, so you need to go and explicitly do it. We have a counter that shows you on the message as a message property how often the message has been delivered. So you can key your dead lettering strategy based on that, or based on some other mechanisms in your app, some exceptions that are being thrown, some local retry mechanisms, whatever you want. If you can't deal with a received message, you call dead letter on it. and that will put it into the origin queues dead letter section. And then you can actually get to the dead letter queue by creating a queue client based on, and then format the dead letter path based on your queue client's path. So that is a subordinate queue of that queue. So it's a special queue sorted underneath the actual queue that will give you access to the dead letter data. We also have, and mentioned that earlier, duplicate detection, which is really interesting for transactional cases. As I think I was mentioning that in the update read separation section, where you can detect, or the system will detect, within a certain time window whether you're getting duplicate messages. So if there's any doubt due to system failure, whether you have already received a message or have already sent a message, you can do that here with the duplicate detection and eliminate any doubt, because the system will catch it and will simply discard the incoming message if it has already been sent. So a good strategy here is to go and create the message IDs in a way that are correlated in some way to the data that you're carrying, so that you can shape the message ID in a fashion that will yield a safe duplicate detection. The message ID doesn't have a particular format, it's just a string. So you can go and use a purchase order ID or whatever you think is the appropriate thing to make sure that you have a unique identifier, and then the system can go and make sure that you don't flow duplicates into the system. And then there's also for high throughput scenarios, there's also a noteworthy thing called prefetch. It's an optimized network behavior that you can turn on. And what they will do is it will prefetch a number of messages into your local client, even if the client hasn't even been asking for them. So you do one receive, and instead of just getting one message, you're getting a batch of 50. So it's kind of like with SQL client, which is if you go and get a result, you get a batch of 100. So you can go and tune this. The upside of that is higher throughput. The downside of that is it may create load imbalance, because you're pulling more messages than you're willing to process right now. And it can also result in message loss if you're doing it in receive and delete mode. If you just walk away from your prefetch messages, or you may be hoarding messages where you just let the locks expire and nobody can get to them, because you just have them sitting in your prefetch buffer for 5 minutes, but you never get to them. So you go and balance throughput with the balancing features. So typically, you will use that prefetch feature mostly if you have jobs that are very, very fast to do and you need to have higher throughput. That's where that helps you. In cases where you have longer jobs and you want to keep that prefetch limit at a very low value and probably at just the default. Summary, that was just a set of the things that we have on the feature list. It was a selection, really. It's not all the features. What you should do is you should go and get the SDK and the associated samples. We're going to go and be talking about Service Bus and the new messaging features and the relay more to you, and we'll help you understanding all these new capabilities. The SDK is going to be available from the download center, from the web platform installer, and it's also where you can get it. And there's going to be a NuGet package. You can install just search for Service Bus inside of Visual Studio. That's how you get the runtime into your project. And most of the advanced features that are talked about, with the exception of transaction support, so system to transaction support, and the exception of sessions, also work all completely on the REST API. And over the next several weeks, we're going to publish samples not only for the .NET framework, but also in a number of other languages and for another other runtimes that are leveraging the REST API to interact with Service Bus, but where you can also leverage the majority of these features from all those various different platforms. So thank you for watching and listening, and I Hope that was helpful, and we're going to give you more over time. Thanks to you.